show is on in less than 1 minute.
Life! Life, you hear me? Is my creation! Life!
So this was fun.
You're gonna like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Are there any questions before we proceed?
Good countdown. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered the restricted broadcast area. You have entered the restricted broadcast area.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you've read?
The Guy James Show. America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Guy James Show. That's right, the one and only Guy James Show, proud liberal Democrat. And we're going to talk to you today about issues within the Democratic Party, and maybe even talking about a few of those nasty Republicans as well. And in particular, we're going to talk about the man I consider to be the greatest Democrat of all, perhaps, and in my mind, without question, without any question, the greatest president that we've had. And I'm talking about Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And we intend to talk today about his famous For Freedom speech. And I know some of you are very familiar with that. Some of you may not be. And it'll be our purpose today to go through that and find out, well, where do you think that it applies today? Do you think Franklin Roosevelt, was that another time? Or do Franklin Roosevelt's Four Freedoms pertain to today? And I think they do. And we'll talk about that in just a little while. Lots going on. I see the stock market's way up today. Oh, boy. Oh, joy. I can't wait for that. yeah. Like it makes any difference to me. I see the stock market's up. And there's going to be probably another rate cut next week. And yet we have one out of every three, or was it one out of every four? I just read a short while ago. Middle-class Americans are eating literally hand-to-mouth, paycheck to paycheck, in serious financial difficulty. So anyway, the market's good for somebody, I guess, and we're glad of that. Those of you that are fortunate enough to be making big bucks off the stock market, great. Good for you. Hey, the Guy James Show is coming to you live today from the blue waters and sandy beaches of beautiful Fort Myers, Naples area, Florida, around the country and around the world. We will not be having any guests today, so it'll be you and me, and we'll just have a cozy little get-together here and talk about this, that, and the other thing. After all, it is a talk show, so... I see Junior was on the tube today talking for a little bit. Tonight we had, of course, that's always a treat. My God, why do these people let him out? Does he suggest that or do they suggest it? I've always wondered about that. Does he say, hell no, I'm the president. I'm going to go talk and you can't stop me. Isn't there anybody in the White House that says, oh, no, Mr. President, don't go out there and talk to the people again. They'll just, you know, you don't talk very well, son. Somebody ought to tell him. Somebody ought to tell him that. I don't know if they have or not, but I guess not. I don't know. 866-546-5254 if you'd like to join the program today. I see another one of the Bushies has bailed out of the White House. Top White House economic advisor, Alan Hubbard, says he's going to leave his post at the end of the year. The Wall Street Journal said that today. His departure would come as the Bush administration is facing a crisis in the mortgage industry. No kidding. That's caused rising housing foreclosure and sparked recession fears. Hey, in an area where I live, just read in the paper today, 1,532 foreclosures last month. 1,532 foreclosures in the month of October. You know, this is a rather populated area, but I'm not talking huge city here. That just boggles my mind. 1,532 repossessions, foreclosures here this past month. You know, I was talking to somebody earlier. The bailiffs at the courthouse that have to, I mean, how many bailiffs do they have? I mean, that's like, if you take those during the week, that's like, how many, 70 a day, 80 a day? I don't know, somewhere around there. They must have a dozen bailiffs out, I have no doubt they do. And this is from the New York Times. I just had to get this in. Mr. Bush, Junior Bush, as we refer to him on this program, from the New York Times, said Mr. Bush made no comment when the Nobel Prize was announced, and today, yesterday, the two stood silently and a bit awkwardly during the photo opportunity. But the president did personally telephone Mr. Gore to extend the invitation, and the White House changed the date of the event so Mr. Gore could attend. Mr. Bush's press secretary, Dana Perino, that intellectual giant and great conversationalist, told reporters the president is willing to let bygones be bygones. The president does not harbor any resentments he never has. What the hell is she talking about? The president does not harbor any bygones, any ill will. He wouldn't let bygones be bygones. Let me see here. they have massive electoral fraud against Al Gore, taking tens of thousands of minorities out of the mix in the election, and then you have a Supreme Court which gives hands the presidency to Junior Bush, and Bush doesn't resent Al Gore. Who wrote this story? I don't know. Man, oh man. And I see the United Nations has officially dropped the United States, get this, from its list of the 10 best countries to live in. That's right. The United Nations has officially dropped the United States from its list of the 10 best countries to live in. That's taken in a lot of considerations, freedom of speech, all your freedoms, monetary, and so forth. Wow. I see the new Pew poll is out, and Junior Bush is hanging in there with 30%, unchanged from October. That's just 1 point up from his all-time low, so I guess you could say he's rebounded in a huge way, up from 29 to 30%. Which goes to show you, and we've preached that message on this show over and over and over again, 30% of the people in the United States are just plain stupid. And you would have to be just plain stupid to still support Junior Bush, support his policies. I understand there are people that say, I'll support the president no matter what, be he Democrat or Republican, he is my president. But 30% of the people still think Junior Bush is doing a good job? Oh, mama. You do have to wonder if you're living next door to some of those folks. If you do, you better put an extra lock on the door. My God, how could he be that stupid? Really. And also, the Sky News in the United Kingdom had an interview with none other than Matt Drudge. You know, we spoke about him a little bit yesterday. And they asked Drudge, they said, big election next year, how big a role do you think the internet and websites will play in the way people make their decision of who to vote for? And Drudge answered, well, it depends what the broadcast outlets do and don't do. Back in the last Clinton administration, during Lewinsky, for instance, which I had to break on the internet because other people wouldn't, If we're again faced with the corporations who don't want to report real news, the internet will play a very valuable role in the underground catching real stories that are in spite. I don't know what he means about that. Is that what Matt Drudge thinks he's doing? Real stories? Real stories? And I also see now the rumors starting. See, we told you, and you knew that. I didn't have to tell you how heated and nasty it would get against Hillary Clinton. The rumors are starting to circulate. Now there's a rumor out that a couple of the big newspapers are sitting on a story about new infidelities of Bill Clinton. They're just sitting on these stories. If they had these stories, let me ask you, why would they sit on them? There can only be one reason they would sit on them. If they're aware of the fact that the public knows they have them, if it is in fact true that they have them, there can only be one reason they would sit on them. And that would be to influence the election next year. Let's say Hillary gets the nomination, then they break the stories, and then they break the back of the Democratic candidate. Mm-hmm. I think we see what's happening here. I can only hope that's not true. I surmise that it is not true, and that it's probably, and I don't know this, but it's probably an ugly rumor being circulated within Republican circles. Anything to hurt the Clintons. Well, as I mentioned, today I wanted to talk a lot about Franklin Roosevelt and the Four Freedoms speech. And if you haven't heard the Four Freedoms speech, it is one of the great oratories in American history, a short speech made in January of 1941 by Franklin Roosevelt, and one of the greatest speeches of all time. I don't think there's any question of that. It's short, it's sweet, and it's just the best. It's Franklin Roosevelt at his best, I think. And who can argue with the oratorical skills of Franklin Roosevelt? The man had it, did he not? He was your dad, your granddad talking to you. You sat and you listened and you respected what he had to say if you were an intelligent human being. Many people disliked Franklin Roosevelt. As I mentioned the other day, the hardcore Republicans hated him, and Franklin Roosevelt knew this. He knew he was hated by a lot of people. You remember his little talk about his little dog Falla, how the press reported that he'd left his little dog Falla, I believe it was in, he was a little Scotty. I think he'd left him in Alaska, supposedly, and sent a destroyer back to get him. That was the story. They did this to discredit and humiliate Franklin Roosevelt. And Franklin Roosevelt, I remember him sitting there with his little dog Falla and explaining this whole thing, that it was not true. And he said, my little dog Falla is Scotch, and he would never put up with something like that. I'm paraphrasing him now. But Franklin Roosevelt delighted in giving it back to those who obviously hated him and hated everything he stood for. And I always just loved the way he spoke to them, and never let it show that he was riled or angry. He always gave better than he got. So we have talked at great length on this program about tax cuts and so forth, about how the Bush people have started a war for their own enrichment, for the enrichment of many of their fat cat friends, and that's what it appears to be. It is a war for oil. It is also a war for greed, in which Defense Department suppliers have gotten filthy rich. Can you say Blackwater? Contractors, no-bid contracts. There are people that have gotten obscenely rich off of the Bush War. And he had the temerity to cut taxes during wartime. I don't know of another time that's ever been done. And so I wanted to briefly play for you an excerpt of Franklin Roosevelt's Four Freedoms speech. I wanted to play for you an excerpt of Franklin Roosevelt where he talks about taxes during wartime. And I think the Bush people should have taken a lesson from him, but they did not. But let's listen to Franklin Roosevelt talk about taxes during wartime, the only sane approach, in my opinion.
I have called for personal sacrifice, and I am assured of the willingness of almost all Americans to respond to that cause. A part of the sacrifice means the payment of more money in taxes. In my budget message, I will recommend that a greater portion of this great defense program be paid for from taxation than we are paying for today. No person should try or be allowed to get rich out of the program.
Nobody should be allowed to get rich out of the program. Franklin Roosevelt knew that taxes should not be cut during wartime. He knew that. Let's start with Franklin Roosevelt's Four Freedoms today. This is about three-quarters of the way through that speech that he talked about the Four Freedoms. And let's just play this, and we'll talk about it afterwards.
In the future days which we seek to make secure, we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms. The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way everywhere in the world. The third is freedom from want, which translated into world terms means economic understandings which will secure to every nation a healthy peacetime life for its inhabitants everywhere in the world. The fourth is freedom from fear, which translated into world terms means a worldwide reduction of armaments to such a point and in such a thorough fashion that no nation will be in a position to commit an act of physical aggression against any neighbor anywhere in the world.
Franklin Roosevelt before the United States Congress laying out his four freedoms, four essential freedoms, and not just for the United States, but for the people of the world. He ended each one of those statements by saying everywhere in the world. And there is no doubt Franklin Roosevelt had a passion for freedom from fear, freedom from want, freedom of speech or expression, and freedom of religion. He had a passion for it because Franklin Roosevelt was a Democrat. Franklin Roosevelt was a real Democrat. He stood proudly for these four things, and I think he enunciated them absolutely beautifully. And the reason I bring this up today about Franklin Roosevelt's four freedoms is, where are we today? I'd like to discuss, where are we today with the four freedoms? And I don't think anybody would argue with those four freedoms that those are essential to people in the world. Absolutely essential. But where are we today in relation to what Franklin Roosevelt was talking about? Oh, yes, you may say that was 66 years ago. And that's true. But what? Nothing has changed about those four freedoms. Those are still the bedrock of things that society needs to get by in this world today. Freedom is about courage. He spoke of freedom in this. And Junior Bush and his people have spoken a lot about freedom. He's thrown that word around willy-nilly. He's never properly defined what he means by freedom, what real freedom is. They've never gone before the American people and leveled with them on just what freedom means here in our country and, for example, in Iraq. I believe he hasn't explained this to the American people because I believe Bush really doesn't have a real understanding of it himself, at least not a valid understanding. Do you think, for example, that the people in Iraq have the assurance that Junior Bush wishes real freedom for them? Think how important that is. We're occupying that country. We went in there under a half a dozen different pretexts to start out, and then it ended up that Junior said, well, you know, no, it wasn't WMDs. It wasn't just to throw out. It was freedom for the Iraqi people. So they'd be able to guide themselves in this world. They wouldn't have an evil dictator looking around, and they'd have their own government, and they'd have freedom. Do you think the Iraqi people are sitting there now assured that Bush actually wishes real freedom for them? Do you think they're free from fear? Do you think most of them are free from want? We know they have very little electricity. We know they're struggling with the lack of jobs. They've got a huge financial crisis in their country. We know they have a huge refugee problem with 2 to 3 million of them not even back in their country right now. We know they've got a terrible problem with sanitary conditions that are just frightening. Are they free from want? I don't think they are. And do they have freedom of religion in Iraq right now, since we're so interested, as Junior Bush says, in promoting freedom and democracy in that country? Do they have freedom of religion? The Shia and the Sunni do what they can to destroy each other. The Jews and the Christians have, for all intents and purposes, left the country. Do they have freedom of religion in Iraq? And freedom of speech or expression? You know, I don't have to tell you, you can get yourself killed in Iraq for speaking out against one side or the other. Has Junior Bush worked for any of the four freedoms in any meaningful way for the Iraqis? Has he? And Junior Bush considers this some kind of victory? We keep hearing that. I don't think so. You know, two of FDR's four freedoms are framed as freedoms to do something. Freedom to speak one's mind, and freedom to worship as you see fit. And the other two freedoms he talks about are freedoms from something. Freedom from want and freedom from fear. Freedom from something is actually a negative liberty. And I looked up the definition of negative liberty. It's the absence of obstacles, barriers, or constraints. Positive liberty is the possibility of acting or the fact of acting in such a way as to take control of one's life and realize one's fundamental purposes. That's a definition. But as Roosevelt said, in every land, there are always at work forces that drive men apart and forces that draw men together. In our personal ambitions, we are individualist, but in our seeking for economic and political progress as a nation, we all go up, or else we all go down as one people. But a true moral politician, as philosopher Immanuel Kant said, needs to find out how to cut through the knot that politics can't untie. And we've got a knot in Iraq right now that politics obviously is not untying that knot, simply not. And, you know, talking about freedom from want, and that, of course, leads into the terrible poverty that we have in the world and even here in this country. The morality of this administration is at stake, and I think we all know where their morality lies now. It's one thing for millions of people to be dying every year because they're too poor to stay alive. That's one thing. But it's another thing for millions to be dying every year because they're too poor to be staying alive, and for us to know it and to not do anything about it. This country's now, I think, it's out of the top 14 on giving aid to poor people around the world and to helping stave off hunger and famine. The reason people die of extreme poverty, and take Darfur, for example, is that they have nothing. They don't need a lot to stay alive. I think we've all seen that. They don't even need a lot to start the process of their own economic development. We wouldn't have to be a bunch of heroes here in order to help save the lives of those people and to help promote some economic development where it's not occurring right now on this planet. And yet we sit idly by a few small programs, but we don't do anything. Where's the morality? It would just take having our eyes open. It would take some attention. It would take a breakthrough in our own country from doing nothing to doing something, because we really are essentially doing nothing right now. And that's the sad, hard fact. We're doing nothing to help millions upon millions of people in this world, hundreds of millions of people, be free from want. In the last few weeks, Bush has spoken 1,000 times about freedom without speaking once about poverty. And that's what we have to change if we're going to address this challenge. It can be changed. Americans down deep inside want to change it. But Americans don't know what we aren't doing and don't know what we could be doing. It's not that the American people are like that. It's not that there's evil or uncaring in this country. It's a lack of understanding of the basic realities, and it's a lack of our leaders leading us to do something about these problems, to set the world free from want. And yet we have done nothing. Let me read you a little bit out of that speech. There is nothing mysterious about the foundations of a healthy and strong democracy. The basic things expected by our people of their political and economic systems are simple. This is Franklin Roosevelt talking. He says those things are equality of opportunity for youth and for others, jobs for those who can't work, security for those who need it, the ending of special privilege for the few, the preservation of civil liberties for all, and the enjoyment of the fruits of scientific progress in a wider and constantly rising standard of living. These are the simple, basic things that must never be lost sight of in the turmoil and unbelievable complexity of our modern world. The inner and abiding strength of our economic and political systems is dependent upon the degree to which they fulfill these expectations. Are those expectations so difficult? Jobs for those who can't work? Security for those who need it? The ending of special privileges for the few and the preservation of civil liberties for all? Are those things that difficult to have? Are they unrealistic expectations? I don't think so. Again, it goes back to the morality of our leaders. It goes back to the morality of this Bush administration that we have right now. And to further quote Franklin Roosevelt in this same speech, many subjects connected with our social economy call for immediate improvement. As examples, we should bring more citizens under the coverage of old age pensions and unemployment insurance. Remember, this is 1941 when he's talking. He goes on to say we should widen the opportunities for adequate medical care. This is 1941. We should plan a better system by which persons deserving or needing gainful employment may obtain it. I have called for personal sacrifice. I am assured of the willingness of almost all Americans to respond to that call. A part of the sacrifice means the payment of more money in taxes. In my budget message, I shall recommend that a greater portion of this great defense program be paid for from taxation than we're paying today. No person should try or be allowed to get rich out of this program, and the principle of tax payments in accordance with ability to pay should be constantly before our eyes to guide our legislation. And then he says, if the Congress maintains these principles, the voters, putting patriotism ahead of pocketbooks, will give you their applause, he says to the Congress of the United States. In the future days, which we seek to make secure, we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms. And he goes back to the freedom from fear, freedom from want, freedom of speech, and freedom of religion. How many of you are familiar with Franklin Roosevelt's four freedoms? I think we studied it in school when I was just a kid. I mentioned before that I lived in an area where a lot of people reviled Franklin Roosevelt, but he didn't care. He just did what was right. And, of course, illustrator and great painter and great American icon, Norman Rockwell, made four paintings to coincide with these four freedoms. He was from Vermont, as you know, and he used his Vermont neighbors to help interpret the staunchly American values contained in the four freedoms that Franklin Roosevelt so eloquently stated, and that was in his State of the Union speech, January 6, 1941. And Rockwell made the four freedom paintings that clearly embodied the spirit of FDR's ideas. And ironically, the government initially rejected Rockwell's offer to create a series of paintings on the four freedoms. However, Rockwell finished the paintings when they were commissioned and publicly circulated in four consecutive issues of the Saturday Evening Post in February, March 1943. And they became four of the best-known posters of World War II, and I'm sure that even inadvertently, you've all seen them and maybe didn't recognize what they were, some of you. And after winning public approval, the four paintings became a motto for the war and for the 1943 bond drive. And they definitely are some of the best artwork done for the war. The painting Freedom of Worship is particularly poignant, in my opinion. Each according to the dictates of his own conscience, it says. There's a beautiful, serene, white-haired lady sitting in solemn prayer, pictured in it. A younger woman with some rosary beads. There's a picture of a thoughtful man next to an elderly black woman, a Jewish man. Basically, it's a cross-section of America. It's a beautiful, beautiful painting for the freedom of worship. And then there's one for freedom of speech. Shows a common man standing to speak in public, in a public open forum, being intently listened to by the rest of the people, maybe in agreement with him, maybe not, but he's being respected and allowed to speak. How different that is from today. And the picture that depicts the freedom from want is something we've, many of us have just experienced this past week. A family gathered for a wonderful meal, smiling, happy, appreciative, enjoying the meal together, and grateful to be able to enjoy the earth's bounty. And perhaps none of the four paintings are as poignant as the Freedom from Fear painting. It shows a standing father and mother standing over the bedside, tucking in the sleeping children. Children peacefully sleeping, not fearful, but secure in the knowledge that they're protected by a loving family. Be sure and check those out, Norman Rockwell's Four Freedom Paintings. Very, very beautiful, beautiful thing to see those and understand what they're talking about. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Back when progressives were fighting for a woman's right to vote and establishing national parks and trying to pass a new plan called Social Security, conservatives fought them every step of the way. And today, it's conservatives trying to move us backwards. It's progressives who are working to protect pensions, provide health insurance for all, and achieve energy independence. America at its best. That's progressive. That's you.
I frame the question in these stark terms.
Are we going to continue to invest American blood and treasure at the same rate we are doing now? For what?
If we continue what you have laid before the Congress here as a strategy, do you feel that that is making America safer?
Sir, I don't know, actually.
This is the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Tune in to Foxed Up with John Fox this Thursday night at his new time, midnight Eastern. We'll take a look at England's bad girl, Amy Winehouse.
I'm someone who can't keep my mouth shut. I will just say what's on my mind, and they will put me in the paper for that. They will say, oh, and she's bitter and twisted about stuff.
So be there, Thursday night, midnight Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no.
This is Billy Shears, and hey, thanks for lending an ear.
Welcome back to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. We're having a discussion this afternoon about Franklin Roosevelt and the Great Four Freedoms speech given in his address before Congress in January of 1941. A man in tune with his times, a man ahead of his times in many ways, a man who was absolutely fearless. I don't know of Franklin Roosevelt ever projecting any fear or danger or anything but the utmost in encouragement to the American people. He projected stability. He brought people back. He brought this country back from a horrible depression from a Republican administration. From an administration obviously didn't know what the hell to do about it. And Franklin Roosevelt was criticized for many of his programs, but they worked. And we came out of the hardest economic times that we've ever been in. And we came out of them through the leadership of one Franklin Roosevelt because of his courage and his ability to lead. And he did lead the masses in this country. And he was, in my opinion, the greatest president we've ever had. We went through some tough times during Roosevelt's tenure as president, during his long tenure as president, four terms. Didn't make it through all four of them. He passed away before in the fourth one. But you didn't hear Franklin Roosevelt fear-mongering. He didn't do that. He did not use fear to control the people of the United States. And we all remember him saying, you have nothing to fear but fear itself. And Franklin Roosevelt believed that. And obviously, the Republicans of today do not believe that. You can't stand for freedom and democracy and also stand for fear. And I think if you've listened to the rhetoric coming from Bush and the candidates for the Republican nomination for president right now, you would have to agree that it has become one of the Republican values as fear. They use it as a tool. Now it's one of their values. They have indeed chosen fear over freedom and democracy. Tell me, of the candidates, the major candidates running for president, the presidency on the Republican side, McCain, has he used fear? Absolutely. Constantly telling us how we need to be very afraid. Mitt Romney? Absolutely. Once again, these guys are all trying to see who can talk the toughest against the rest of the world, particularly the world of Islam, as if they're all terrorists. And as you well know, they're not. And who talks terror and who talks fear anymore and any more explicitly than Rudy Giuliani? Fear is Rudy Giuliani's main weapon in this fight to get the Republican nomination. Rudy Giuliani uses fear every single day. That shows weakness, in my opinion. That's not strength by those people running for the Republican nomination. The American people are stronger than that. And although the American people have been influenced by fear, they've allowed the Bush administration and these Republican candidates for president to talk them into being afraid, be very afraid. A significant percentage of the population lives in fear. I will not live in fear. I know many of you will not live in fear. Just because somebody tells us that we have to live in fear, as I mentioned yesterday, nothing has changed since 9/11. 9/11 should not change our way of life in this country. We should not allow 9/11 to change the way of life in this country. Allowing 9/11 and allowing fear to guide us, allowing fear to govern us, allowing fear to cause a Congress of the United States to pass laws limiting our freedom, that is weakness. And the American people, by and large, over the decades, have not been weak. We go on with our way of life. Yes, we're careful. Yes, we look out for terror. Yes, we put up roadblocks wherever we can against terror, but we do not allow it to change our basic way of life and show it as a weakness as a country. And that's what the Republicans would have us do. You know, so many times we've sat and listened to them talk about how the Democrats want to control your lives. You've heard that mantra for years and years and years from the Republicans. They want big government, the Democrats do. They want to take over your lives with big government and control you with big government. What is more controlling than putting the entire populace of the United States in fear? What is more controlling than that? Frankly, to be honest, what works any better than that? If you don't listen to what I tell you, you'll get killed. If you don't listen to what I'm telling you, if you don't do what I say, if you don't allow us to take away some of your freedoms and your rights and your privacy, if you don't allow us to do that, you'll die. That's the message of the Republican Party. That's fear. That's trying to rule with fear because you can't do it any other way in an honest and open society. That's the way they figure it. They have nothing else to put forth, so they will use fear. What else have they done in the last 20 years? Fear. Ronald Reagan preached fear constantly. Oh, we got to look out. The Russians are coming. And then it's Saddam Hussein's going to get us. The whole world's got WMDs and they're going to get us. Oh no. We have to go to a war in Iraq. We have to protect ourselves. Fear. Think about it. What other substantive argument have they been able to use to govern in this country? Nothing. They've used fear ever since that fateful day of 9/11. I'm tired of hearing it. I'm tired of hearing about the threat levels. I'm tired of hearing about Islamo-fascist around every tree, behind every tree. I'm tired of hearing them preach that to the youth of this country. They're manipulating the people in this country with fear, and that's one of the ugliest things you can possibly do, is to use fear to bring people to your bidding. It is wrong. And Rudy, the most egregious violator of that, McCain, right in there behind him, Romney, all preaching fear every single day. Freedom from fear. That's one of the four things that Roosevelt was talking about. Freedom from fear. And here we have the modern Republican Party using it as a bulwark in their campaigns, using it to control the people of the United States. We showed a resolve in the Second World War. People weren't afraid. They got over the initial shock of Pearl Harbor. They knew that submarines were patrolling off the coast of New York and the east coast of the United States and even into the Gulf of Mexico and by New York. They knew the Nazi submarines were there. They knew the threats. But America did not live in fear in war with Japan and with Germany. We didn't live in fear. We had a resolve. We got the job at hand done. We were victorious, and we were not fearful. And it was all done because Franklin Roosevelt refused and preached to the country that we are Americans. We do not live in fear. As you can tell, I have high regard for Franklin Roosevelt. Always have. I explained to someone earlier today that I was raised in a Yellow Dog Democratic family. My father was in the Second World War. My father adored Franklin Roosevelt. And I don't want to sit here and say that Franklin Roosevelt was perfect. He certainly was not. And some of the things he did as the President of the United States, I didn't particularly care for. And the internment camps of the Japanese was one glaring example right there of where they compromised and should not have. But when you put it all on the scales, I think the results are overwhelming. that Franklin Roosevelt guided America through a very, very, very tough time. And just knew how to keep America from being afraid all the time. Why don't we rely on our strength? Why is the Bush administration trying to make us rely on fear? Why is that? It's because they want to control you, and they want to use fear to do it. Franklin Roosevelt said the fourth of his four freedoms is freedom from fear anywhere in the world. You know, as I mentioned, for FDR, who had experienced two world wars, freedom from fear meant a worldwide reduction of armaments. And the building of a collective security mechanism. Collective security, along with human rights and economic cooperation. In the view of Bush administration officials, the collective September 11th, you know, the circumstances under which we define the lawful use of force no longer exist. I mean, we had overwhelming military might, and it's unlikely we're going to be engaged in a conventional warfare with another nation state. Rather, you know, we've got a new class of enemy. I think we all know that. And that new class consists of non-state people who really flout the conventions of war by targeting civilians. That's nothing new. And they're threatening to use nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. And all of that shows us that we need some new criteria for the use of force and for the handling of any enemy combatants. Some of the old ways won't necessarily do. You know, concerning that painting I mentioned about Norman Rockwell, where he portrayed freedom from fear by showing the American parents tucking their kids safely into bed. And really it depicted the 1940 Battle of Britain, and in doing so, he called on Americans to be thankful that the war wasn't being fought on their own soil. And now the terrorists have attacked American cities. Does this give the United States justification to rewrite the government rules of using force? I don't think it does. And for sure, the Bush administration's shift to a preventative war strategy has had a profound consequence for the rest of the world. And first and foremost, it paved the way for the United States to act in the name of self-defense against Iraq in the spring of 2003. There wasn't an imminent or an actual armed attack from that country. And the UN didn't approve of that. Didn't approve of our going in there. You know, the argument from Bush was that the Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction and they could pass them on to terrorists. And so we had a greater risk by not taking action. They wanted revisions to the Geneva Convention. The Bush administration's security strategy also paved the way for revisions to the Geneva Convention as they applied to unlawful combatants. And you know, here we return to FDR's first freedom, freedom of speech and expression. We had Bush and his people looking for a way to get around it, to get around the international legal norms so that Bush could essentially declare any of us here to be an enemy combatant and lock us away without giving us access to a lawyer or indeed without even charging us with anything. What they wanted was the ability to let military necessity overrule the Geneva principles. And, you know, the Supreme Court ruled on that and declared it to be illegal. So, Americans still fearful? Has the administration attempted to direct all major policy toward winning this war on terror? Has that resulted in less fear? I don't think it has. The sad part is that the post-9/11 trauma is still lingering. And a lot of Americans remain paranoid about their own safety. And I don't think they remain paranoid for any other reason than because Bush and his people have preached that now nonstop for all these years. On the one hand, we see the president and his people and his administration talking about the importance of freedom and democracy. And on the other hand, we have sort of a, you know, an underside to that policy. The notion that we have to behave even more badly than our enemies because that's the only way to get their respect. You know, Rumsfeld said, well, we got to take the gloves off. I think we need to listen to the words of Franklin Roosevelt and stop trying to run this country with fear. Stop trying to run the American foreign policy with fear. Let's start running the American foreign policy with actual diplomacy. Sitting down and talking. Working with people who may be our enemies. Don't have to concede to them. But there are many conditions that are involved in the problems that we have right now, and we're not addressing any of them. We're not addressing any of the problems at all. And I think we need to. You know, Franklin Roosevelt said, we have nothing to fear but fear itself, and I think that's as true now as it was then. Fear is weakness. And I think we have shown enemies that we have around the world, and to be sure, we do have some enemies. But I think our actions since 9/11 have shown them, at least our governmental actions, our leaders' actions, have shown them that we do have fear as a nation. And that's the wrong thing to put forth. When people know you are afraid, you are more vulnerable than ever. You cannot allow your enemies the luxury of knowing that you are afraid and that every little thing you do strikes fear in their hearts. That's not the American way. That's not the way that... Not how this country was founded, certainly in the Revolutionary War. Oh, to be sure, there are people on the battlefield that have fear, and there are people fear for the lives of their loved ones that are off to war and fighting in a war. I mean, there's that kind of fear. But I'm talking about the fear that grips a nation, thinking there's a boogeyman behind every building. And that's what the Bush people have done for the last over 6 years. Is to try and convince the American public to just let us handle it. We will be responsible for your safety. Don't you worry. You just give up a few of your rights. And that FISA thing, and that NSA spying thing, don't you worry about that. And if we listen in on a few of your phone calls, we have to do that because we're your government and we're protecting you from terrorism because we know you're afraid and you're afraid because we told you you need to be. So, give up a few of your freedoms. Well, it's not so bad, is it? So long as you're safe. So long as we can keep you and your family from being killed by those horrible Islamo-fascists who probably come over and get you tonight if we, you know, weren't watching so carefully. Just leave it all up to us. We'll take care of you. But be afraid. Be very afraid. Threat level orange or whatever it is right now, but be afraid. Don't you ever forget it. Don't you ever relax. Stay afraid. It's a terrible thing what the Bush administration has done to the people of the United States by fear-mongering day in, day out, month in, month out. You're listening to The Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. We're going to be back right after the news. Don't go anywhere.
This is the Quality News Network. At the White House, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas are committing to negotiate a peace treaty by the end of 2008. The two countries are pledging to work on issues including the dismantling of Israeli settlements in the West Bank and the status of Jerusalem. This is the first time in 7 years the two countries have initiated direct negotiations with one another. Further peace talks are scheduled for next month. On the West Bank, Palestinian police loyal to President Abbas fired shots in the air and beat protesters with sticks during the funeral of a man killed during a protest against the Mideast Peace Summit. According to medics, at least 26 people were wounded. Pakistan President General Pervez Musharraf officially stepped down as his country's military commander today, fulfilling a key opposition demand. Musharraf will be sworn into his second term as president tomorrow. In Saudi Arabia, over 200 al-Qaeda-linked terrorist suspects have been arrested in recent months, according to the Interior Ministry. The anti-terrorism sweep is Saudi Arabia's largest to date. French President Nicolas Sarkozy returned early from a diplomatic mission to China in order to address the third night of youth riots in suburbs of Paris and Toulouse. Cars and buildings have been set afire, more than 100 police officers injured. The riots were sparked by the death of two boys Sunday in a police chase. A Chinese warship sailed into Tokyo Harbor today for the first time in more than 50 years. The ship is on a tentative mission, signaling an effort to diminish long-standing hostility between the two Asian neighbors. In Oklahoma City, a wealthy businessman has promised to bail out Oral Roberts University with a $70 million donation. Last week, the school's president resigned after he was accused of using university funds to pay for his luxurious lifestyle. In Las Vegas, O.J. Simpson has pled not guilty to kidnapping and armed robbery charges. U.S. fourth graders aren't reading as well as other children around the world, according to results of a global reading test. The results released today showed U.S. students who took the test last year scored about the same as they did in 2001, the last time the test was given. Tonight, CNN and YouTube sponsor a televised debate of Republican candidates for president. The show airs live at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You're listening to the Quality News Network.
Tired of all the griping? Got to get away from the propaganda of the left and the right? Tune in weekdays at noon Pacific right here on the Quality News Network for America Back on Track with me, your correspondent, Tony Seaton. We don't wallow in the dialectic between the donkeys and the elephants. America Back on Track rises above the fray, representing the people's right, the people's need to know. America Back on Track from the Quality News Network puts the news in context, delivers scintillating interviews and commentary, all part of a conversation with America. America Back on Track is for information-hungry Americans who know how vital it is to the health of the country that the citizens know the facts. America Back on Track, weekdays at noon on KRML 1410 AM in the Monterey area and streaming live online at QualityNewsNetwork.com.
Home prices have fallen 4.5%, the steepest drop in 20 years. Sales of existing homes and condominiums fell in October for the eighth month in a row. The nation's fifth largest bank, Wells Fargo, announced it will absorb $1.4 billion in quarterly losses as a result of loan defaults. The California-based bank cited foreclosures in its home state and throughout the Midwest. Financial aid to help third world nations adapt to natural disasters due to global warming will cost the world's richest nations an estimated $86 billion annually by the year 2015. According to a UN panel of experts, half of those funds will be spent on improvements to infrastructure. The FCC has rejected a plan to place the country's cable TV companies under tighter government control. The plan would have forced greater program diversity upon cable stations. The Dow Jones Industrials up more than 200 points for the second day amid rumors out of the Federal Reserve that interest rates will decrease. Light sweet crude is trading at $91.15 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. And on Wall Street this hour, the Dow is up 323 points, the NASDAQ is up 79 points, and the S&P 500 is up 37 points. There's more on our website at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Christine Kendall.
Throw the second switch! Throw the third switch!
Not the third switch!
show is on in less than 1 minute.
Life! Life, you hear me? Give my creation life!
So this was fun.
You're going to like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Get countdown. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered the restricted broadcast area. You have entered the restricted broadcast area.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you've read?
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Thank you for joining us this afternoon here in the Guy James Show, a member of the Head On Radio Network. We're glad to have you along with us this afternoon, and do appreciate your listenership very much. And you know, I really do appreciate all the emails and notes I get from you, and letters, and it warms my heart a lot of times. We wonder, you know, there are times where you wonder, is it all worth it? we work hard on trying to bring you a show every day, a good show every day, an interesting show, and I know not every day is appealing to all people, but we try and have something across the board that'll appeal to most people of the demographic that we're looking for. Liberal Democrats, and we're talking about one of those subjects today, Franklin Roosevelt and his Four Freedoms speech, and we've mentioned the Norman Rockwell paintings of such, something that many of you have seen and may not even realize why those were painted or when or by whom. Google that, and if you're online, and I know you all are, be sure and Google that, and check out the Norman Rockwell Museum and the paintings and what they stand for and what Norman was getting at when he painted them. The old Saturday Evening Post and Norman Rockwell. My goodness. I think the last paintings he did for Saturday Evening Post, if my memory serves me correct, was right around 1963. And that might have been the demise of the magazine itself then, but I'm not sure. And I don't know. I don't know when Norman Rockwell passed away. Perhaps some of you do. But what a great purveyor of Americana! How could you do any better than Norman Rockwell? We are talking this afternoon of about Franklin Roosevelt's Four Freedoms speech and what it meant to the world at the time, and more specifically, how it translates into today. And how can it be that something so eloquent, so very important, so germane to the problems of the day, how can it be that that's being so ignored in this modern day and age? I can't think of another time when it would be more important than to be have freedom from fear, freedom from want. We all know that our freedom of speech and our expression is gradually being eroded. And the freedom of a religion to worship the way you want to, if you want to, where you want to. Our freedoms are in jeopardy. And that's not how it should be in a modern society. We've come 66 years since Franklin Roosevelt gave this speech. And I don't think, in many respects, I don't think we've progressed at all. You know, you stop and think about the freedom of speech. Franklin Roosevelt said that the first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. And he meant everywhere in the world. You know, he could have talked specifically just about the United States. But Franklin Roosevelt understood that if we're going to be successful in this country, if we're going to be prosperous in this country, if we're going to be free, if we're going to be safe, that a lot of that depends on conditions in the rest of the world, that we're not an island amongst unto ourselves. We can't be isolationist, although the Republicans in his day certainly wanted us to be isolationist. They preached against getting involved in the Second World War. Not that anybody likes war. And especially at a time when Hitler and Mussolini were hell-bent on destroying free speech. I think Americans at the time must have appreciated the reminder that a freedom was alive and well here in America and in their local communities. I don't think it does me any good to go on and on and on today about the internment camps. It was wrong. It was a mistake by the Roosevelt administration. It most certainly was. Although nobody was barred from saying it was in our freedom of speech. But a lot of these things today that they talk about, the Patriot Act, the authority of law enforcers to investigate and as the Bush people would put it, preempt potential attacks of terrorism. The U.S. government now has far-ranging powers, including the ability to conduct these so-called sneak and peek searches and to get your private records and to use secret proceedings in immigration cases. And the FBI now can get your get a person's medical and financial and other records in terrorism cases without getting the judge's approval. So our rights and our freedoms, many of them are being eroded, and I forget, you know, everything's attributed to Ben Franklin or Winston Churchill, but something or other, how does the saying goes, trade a little temporary safety for liberty, and deserve neither safety or liberty. I know I mangled it there, but you know what I mean. And that's what we're doing. We are, in fact, right now trading our liberty for a little temporary safety, and by doing that, we probably don't deserve either. And I hope we can get around that. I hope we can come back and understand as a country that that's not how it's going to be. And I know a lot of Americans believe that this expansion of government powers is justified because of the threats of the terrorists here in our own soil. But others fear the consequences of allowing the intelligence and the law enforcement agency to monitor and confront people who are exercising their First Amendment rights. And a lot of people have expressed concern about the cost and the perils of stifling political dissent. And you have got to have and allow political dissent to have a functioning democracy. I don't think there's any question about that. And I find it very, very troubling that American citizens don't feel free anymore to debate the problem of terrorism openly without questioning one another's patriotism. That's just plain wrong. That clampdown on political protest, zones that they set up when Bush is going to speak or Cheney's going to speak someplace. My God. You know, that was the clampdown was particularly apparent in a period leading up to the Iraq War when, dissenters were branded as un-American and they became the subject of media attacks and hate websites and death threats and the loss of their jobs in some cases. You know, there are positive images of America that, still around the world as a beacon of human rights and liberation. And favorable opinions of U.S. actions have been declining worldwide. I think you know that. We've talked about it ad nauseum on this program, particularly since we've invaded Iraq. I was looking at a recent Pew Center poll. Majorities in a number of countries felt that the United States was not sincere in its efforts to curb international terrorism. Harsh actions against Muslims, not only in the United States, but also in Afghanistan and Guantanamo and Iraq. They got all these tough obstacles now for foreigners trying to get into the United States. And some of that's all right. You know, got the supports for crackdowns on human rights abroad by governments friendly to the goals of this war on terror. Shouldn't it be called freedom from terror? Shouldn't that be what we're doing? All these things have contributed to this broadening and deepening of anti-American sentiment to the point where many now regard the United States as the major threat to world peace. Now, Franklin Roosevelt thought we ought to have the freedom and democracy everywhere, and oddly enough, while this so-called war on terror has restricted our freedoms here in this country, it looks like it's accelerated the campaign to introduce such freedoms abroad. They talk a good game. They say we're promoting democracy in the Middle East. That's supposedly the centerpiece of our U.S. foreign policy. And as Bush put it in his second inaugural address, the hope is that successful elections in Iraq will inspire democratic reformers from Damascus to Tehran, he said. The establishment of a free Iraq at the heart of the Middle East will be a watershed event in the global democratic revolution. Well, I think they're right in making that statement, but I also think that they've gone about it in a hell of an odd way if they want to establish, help establish democracy, if that's what the people want in that region. So it makes you ask, you know, what criteria can we use to measure the successful, implementing of democracy in countries outside of the United States? You know, Condoleezza Rice asked, can a person walk into the middle of the town square and express his or her views without fear of arrest, imprisonment, or physical harm? Is that the criteria we use? Frankly, I'll be a whole lot more comfortable with the American policy of democracy promotion if the government would behave more consistently here at home. And I'd feel better if we took it seriously in countries where we get along more or less with the government, like Saudi Arabia. And I'd be happier if the administration were more thoughtful about the means that they use for achieving democracy. Building democracy is a long, long, long-term political process, and that's not how things happen after an invasion. But I really think America as a nation has been seen around the world to have lost its moral compass as a result of the fears that have been brought on by 9/11. And I reiterate, the fear that resulted from 9/11 was not the act itself. It was not the blowing up of the Twin Towers and hitting with the airplanes. That was not what caused the fear. Oh, yes, we were all horrified. But the Bush administration took that and ran with it and trumpeted fear and terror every single day. You couldn't turn on the TV set. You know, the fears are understandable. Terrorism is, after all, it really is the antithesis of respect for human rights. The people that indulge in terrorism don't have any respect for human rights. I know that. But I don't think that the Bush administration and our government so far has been able to strike any kind of a reasonable balance between freedom of speech and freedom from fear. I, I'll agree that after attack of the proportions of 9/11, that briefly, you know, you might have to restrict rights to secure the public order and protect us against things like terrorism. But the limitations should be modest, and they should be short-term. They should be absolutely temporary. And they shouldn't be based on any kind of racial or ethnic discrimination. And it's typical. I mean, the United States has been inclined to clamp down too broadly when faced with security threats. The incarceration of the Japanese Americans, I mentioned, as being a prime example. But, you know, when Al-Qaeda commits what are essentially crimes against humanity, the human rights community should actively work with the government to stop their activities. You know, it begs the question, should the United States be involved right now? Should democracy promotion be the integral part of U.S. foreign policy? Should that be what we're trying to do around the world, is to force democracy on people? And if that is the goal, what are the most ethical means for doing it? You know, you could ask the question, is the use of force justified? I'd say absolutely not. And you also have to ask the question, and my answer is clear, but is yours, has the U.S. clamped down too broadly on civil liberties in response to these security threats? I think they have. I think they've gone overboard. And you might ask the question, by the same token, are human rights advocates guilty of playing down the importance of security concerns because of a preoccupation with the abuse of detainees and prisoners? I don't think so. It's just sad and it's just tragic that the freedom of speech and expression there's been a campaign to stifle it here in this country, and that is not what we're all about, never have been, and I hope to God we never will be. But the Bush people have certainly done what they can to promote it. I'm going to pause for a short break. We'll be right back.
Clover, don't want an old horseshoe. Want your kiss, cause I just can't miss with a good luck charm like you. Come on and be my little good luck charm. Hey, you sweet delight. I want a good luck charm hanging on my arm. A two high, a two high, a two hope, a two hope. Tonight. Don't want a silver dollar, rabbit's foot on a string. The happiness and your warm caress, no rabbit's foot can bring. Come on and be my little good luck charm, you sweet delight. I want a good luck charm hanging on my arm. A two hat, a two hat, a two hope, a two hope, a two night. Oh yeah. A two night. If I found a love, I toss it across the bay. Your love is worth all the gold on earth. No wonder that I say, come on and be my little good luck charm. Hey, you sweet delight. I want a good luck charm hanging on my arm. A two hat, a two hat, a two hope, a two hope, a two night. Oh, yeah.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor and the rich get rich. That's how it goes. And everybody knows. Everybody knows the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling. Like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking into their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. Everybody knows. Just a shining artifact of the past. And everybody knows the scene is dead. But there's gonna be a meter on your bed that will disclose what everybody knows. Everybody knows that you're in trouble. Everybody knows what you've been through. Cross on top of Calvary to the beach at Malibu. Everybody knows it's coming apart. Take one last look at this sacred heart before it blows. Everybody knows.
Thanks for joining us here this afternoon on the Guy James Show. Glad to have all of you along. We've been discussing Franklin Roosevelt's Four Freedoms speech and how it applies to today's America and to today's world. And I think in many cases it's not applying very well. We have not applied it very well. Same principles of that speech still stand today. They're as good as gold and always will be. But are we using Franklin Roosevelt's wisdom? I don't think so. And that's a shame, because he's one of the wisest men that ever governed in this country. Wow, we heard a little tune there from, not a little tune, a long tune actually, from Don Henley. Did you see that interview with the Eagles on TV the other night? Wow. You know, sometimes you lose track. I'm not one of these ones that knows the lyrics to all the songs and knows all the songs of every artist and don't even remember a lot of that, unless it happened to be of the time when I was a teenager when you were really into that thing. But I love musicians. Music. I'm a musician myself, and yet I don't have an anthology in my head of Don Henley's or the Eagles or all that. I don't do that. I just know what I like, and I listen, and if it's something that's, you know, but I heard him start talking about the list of songs that the Eagles, I hadn't thought about it. One huge hit after another, after another, after another, and the show chronicled the days, you know, the drugs and the women and all the things that they, and, you know, the little fights they had within the band and all that, and, you know, they pretty much broke up and didn't play again for I don't know how long, and it seems like the Eagles come back like once every 10 or 15 years, whether they need to or not, and believe me, I think they just need to, but... Wow, this latest album they come out. I think they said it's got 20 or 22 cuts on it. I've heard half dozen of them. Some of their very best work. I love the Eagles. I always have. And heads up on that for you Eagles fans. This new one they just come out with. And I heard Henley say that, you know, we'd rather do something really big every dozen years than have a so-so album every year, and I couldn't agree more. If you're going to leave a body of work behind, don't leave a bunch of crap and a few good songs. Have fewer and have them all be gold, you know? I hardly agree with that. But anyway, I can't think of what it's called, the new Eagles album that's out. Do we still call them albums? I don't know. CDs, whatever. But the latest out by the Eagles. I don't know how I got sidetracked on that, but I did nonetheless. I want to finish up talking about the Franklin Roosevelt's Four Freedoms, and I hadn't talked much yet about the freedom of worship, and Franklin said in his speech that the second freedom is the freedom of every person to worship God in his own way everywhere in the world. And I would include in on that, or the freedom not to. That's somebody's personal business. And I don't think we have a right to intrude. I don't care what it is. We don't have a right to intrude on a person's religion. If they want to have any particular religiosity, fine. And I would never dream of getting in one of those debates that my religion's better than yours. And I think that's so silly. I know. Some of you may be listening that are Southern Baptist right now and go, what do you mean by that? We're the only true way. And somebody else, you might be Catholic, yeah, well, no, we're the only true way. No, I keep mine to myself, but I'm not about to tell somebody else who's wrong. I would not do that. I have never done that, and I will not. I'm very broad-minded when it comes to that. Very tolerant, I guess you might say, too. But FDR did include the right to worship as the second, his second of his four freedoms, and that's important. It's important to this country. This country, there is a spiritual nature to this country, no matter how you want to frame it. And religious freedom and tolerance are intimately bound up with the rights to free thought and free speech and to the other freedoms of peaceful assembly into association. And I hope that religious liberty is something that always prevails in this country. you know, do what you want to do. George Bush is taking it one step too far. You know, religion lies at the heart of American politics right now, and I don't think it should. One of the nation's greatest and maybe maybe one of the least understood ironies is that religion really does play a pivotal role in motivating and shaping the way that America views itself and its mission to the world. And I'm not so sure that's something we ought to be involved in. But, you know, George Bush's rhetoric of good and evil, you know, his insistence that Americans have been called to spread the almighty gift of freedom to every man and woman in the world, those are his words, has often been attributed to his ties to the religious right. You know, he said that this is the very same vision that runs through American foreign policy from the beginning, even back before America became its own country. Well, can it, George? Keep it to yourself. You know, I've heard some of Bush's supporters say that, and I think it's laughable in a lot of ways. I would never say this if I were one of them, but I've heard several of them say that he resembles in some way, you know, George Bush, and I've heard him compared to Harry Truman. But particularly, they've compared him, a couple of writers that I've seen, to Teddy Roosevelt. I know, don't laugh, stick with me here. You know, and when Teddy Roosevelt was the vice president, he went on this wild campaign in the Philippines and in Mexico, and he justified his expansionist policy on the grounds that America had and he used the word, had a calling to take its religious beliefs to the world. Oh my God, can you say crusades? That's what it sounded like. And the progressives of Roosevelt's era believed that it was God who wanted the United States to dominate the Western Hemisphere. As, where I dug up a quote today by the Senator Albert Beveridge in 1900. He said, "He has marked us as his chosen people, henceforth to lead the regeneration of the world." Well, that'll get you in trouble every time with the rest of the people of the world. And, you know, Bush has taken care to stress the nation's tradition of religious tolerance. And he stated in his second inaugural speech that the national character is sustained, and these are Bush's words, is sustained by the truths of Sinai, the Sermon on the Mount, the words of the Quran, and the varied faith of our people. And yet, here we are in this so-called war on terror, and it looks like the United States is engaged in some sort of a moral struggle against those of other religious persuasions. That's exactly what it seems like to the other people of the world. And then we had this idiot, Lieutenant General, you remember him, William Boykin, who made his stupid remarks. I forget where he was speaking, but he said, I knew that God was, my God was bigger than his. I knew that my God was a real God and his was an idol. He said in reference to Saddam Hussein. So we've done some pretty stupid things religiously, but it remains in this country that you do have the freedom to worship as you wish, and you should, as long as you don't force it on somebody else. And so far, we haven't gone the extra mile on doing that. And finally, I wanted to mention just briefly, Roosevelt, one of Roosevelt's four freedoms that he talked about was the freedom from want. And he followed it by saying everywhere in the world. He said that behind all four of his freedoms. And I think that's extremely important when you talk about the freedom from want. When FDR took office, the country was in the depths of the Great Depression. And you know, so for the start of his very first administration, Roosevelt had a high priority, or he wouldn't have gotten a second term. He had a high priority on securing freedom from want. And he knew, he could see, and everybody could see that freedom from want is essential to the long-term strength of a country. And along came Social Security and unemployment insurance and ADC and the minimum wage and housing and stock market regulation and the FDIC. Those are just a few of the things that Roosevelt put in. The CCC and many employment situations that they set up by the government to put people to work. His New Deal programs, and a lot of them are still with us. And Roosevelt realized that freedom from want has to be something that spreads throughout the world, because one nation is not going to sit there while the whole rest of the world starves to death. The rest of the world is not going to let that happen. So he mentioned, and I'll quote him, he says, "Necessitous men are not free men. People who are hungry and out of a job are the stuff of which dictatorships are made," and truer words were never spoken. During his first administration, Roosevelt informed everybody that, American democracy couldn't survive if a third of the nation, and that's what we were talking about back during the Great Depression, during the depths of it, a third of the nation was ill-housed, ill-clothed, and ill-fed. And then during his second term, he urged the further recognition that American welfare, you just couldn't assure the welfare of America, the future of America, in a disordered and an impoverished world economy. He recognized that the rest of the world can't be in poverty, or we'll end up that way ourselves. That, we needed to come to some sort of economic understanding that'll secure for every nation on earth some sort of a healthy peacetime life for its inhabitants. It can't be a world of untold prosperity for some and poverty for anybody else. That's not going to work. The world isn't going to go on that way. And yet, right here in our own country, there's still significant numbers of Americans who are hungry and poor. Oh, the Republicans never want to admit that. Oh, hell, nobody's poor. Everybody's got a TV set. I love that answer. They always come back with the TV set answer and a VCR or whatever, DVD player, whatever's. They always have to throw that in there. Well, they got one of them. They can't be poor. But a lot of Americans still hungry. Still poor. As late as 2003, almost 37 million people experiencing food insecurity here in this country. Not only do we have to end poverty here in our own country, Roosevelt realized that, but we have to take every step possible to end poverty and hunger in the rest of the world. Because freedom from want is something that's important to every human being on this planet. And this nation, along with any other successful nations around the world, are not going to survive if tens, hundreds of million people are without food and the dignity of a decent life. And I think America needs to understand that we're living on borrowed time here if we don't address that. If we don't look at the problems that are taking place in Darfur and other poor nations in the world, that our democracy is not going to last long term if we continue and if the rest of the world continues to completely ignore these things. That's not the way to be. That's not the American way. And I certainly hope the people in this country and the next administration coming in will recognize that. 866-546-5254 if you'd like to call the program today. I did want to mention a little bit what we're dealing with right now, and And I think you know by now that I'm not a big Rudy Giuliani guy. Giuliani, and this is an ABC from ABC News today. You know, it's no wonder his kids don't want to be seen in public with him. Presidential candidate Rudolph Giuliani hired a Catholic priest to work in his consulting firm months after the priest was accused of sexually molesting two former students and an altar boy and told by the church to stop performing his priestly duty. This Giuliani hired him after that. The priest, Monsignor Alan Placa, a longtime friend of Giuliani, and the priest who officiated at his second wedding to Donna Hanover, continues to work at Giuliani Partners in New York to the outrage of some of his accusers and victims groups, which have begun to protest at Giuliani campaign events. The man did unjust things, and he's being protected and employed and taken care of. It's not a good thing, said one of his accusers, Richard Tolner, who says Placa molested him repeatedly when he was a student at a Long Island, New York Catholic boys' high school in 1975. Well, be that as it may, at a campaign appearance in Milwaukee last week, Giuliani continued to defend Placa, who he described to reporters as a close friend for 39 years. Well, Rudy, I know everybody just loves to have child molesters as close friends. Rudy says, I know the man, I know who he is, so I support him. We give some of the worst people in our society the presumption of innocence and benefits of the doubt. And, of course, I'm going to give that to one of my closest friends. Well, Rudy, you do some strange things and you say some strange things, but the actions of hiring a child molester after the accusations and after the testimony before a grand jury seems a bit strange to me. And also, pertaining to Mr. Rudy Giuliani, a Pennsylvania man convicted... Now, keep in mind, we've got your Bernie Kerik, and by the way, for weeks now, some people have been following Giuliani's campaign, have been following him around New Hampshire, but some guy in a Rudy mask carrying a sign that says, Free Bernie. But today, outside the politics and eggs breakfast there, the masked man was joined by a friend, a man in a mask closely resembling Bernie Kerik. The Kerik impersonator took the Free Bernie sign, while the faux Rudy carried one that said, Best Friends Forever. They waved at passerby and were quick to hug each other when the cameras started rolling. When asked to identify themselves, the two men pointed to photos of Giuliani and Kerik. Oh my, Rudy, will you ever learn? And then there's a story today that a Pennsylvania man convicted in a notorious corruption case, played host to former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani at a fundraiser last night, despite the Giuliani campaign's public efforts to distance itself from the man. Bob Asher, a major Pennsylvania Republican player as a National Party committeeman, was one of the four hosts for the $2,300 a person event. Asher was convicted in 1986 on charges stemming from a bribery scheme intended to win a $300,000 state government contract. Now, Rudy hooks up not only with a guy that's a con man, but a con man that bribed people within the government. And here he is, Rudy, running for the presidency of the United States. The case gained national attention when his co-defendant in the case, and I know a lot of you remember this, Pennsylvania State Treasurer Bud Dwyer, committed suicide at a televised news conference. Asher was sentenced to serve 1 year in prison, and at that time, Giuliani was a federal prosecutor in New York, building a reputation by locking up criminals for similar corruption-related misdeeds. Giuliani came and went from last night's fundraiser without comment, ducking down, and this is the part I love about this story. Giuliani came and went from last night's fundraiser without a comment, ducking down in his car as ABC News cameras attempted to photograph him arriving. The criminal himself that Rudy associates himself with made himself a little more available than the candidate. He said, that's 21 years ago, so we'll just let that all go. I did what I did, and I paid my dues for it. So, Rudy's got quite a little entourage going around there, doesn't he? Man who, I don't know, odds on, the favorite right now to be the presidential candidate for the Republicans. You got con men and thieves holding guilty of government bribery, corruption, holding fundraisers for him. You've got child molesters on working for him on his staff, and guys with Rudy and Bernie masks going around following him around the campaign. This is, and you know, that's to say nothing of the egregious violations that Bernie Kerik is accused of. So, you know, it kind of makes you wonder about this man's judgment. What kind of judgment does Rudy Giuliani have? Evidently, damn poor judgment. Very poor judgment, evidently. I don't know. Seems odd to me that a man run for president of the United States and have these kind of people around him. Going to pause for a quick break. Be right back.
To see I've gone, for tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun. Someday you'll know I was the one, but tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun. And now the time has come, and so my love I must go. And though I lose a friend, in the end you will know. Oh, one day you'll find that I have gone, but tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun. Tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun. And now the time has come, and so my love I must go. And though I lose a friend, in the end you will know. Oh, one day you'll find that I have gone, but tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun.
Ah, yes, the Beatles. Love that little tune, short and sweet. 866-546-5254 if you'd like to get a quick call in here on the show today. I know I've been doing all the talking today. We'll open it up and allow you a moment or two if you get a chance. I was just looking at another Rudy Giuliani story, and you know, it just it's inconceivable to me that the Republican voters would even consider this man for the office of the presidency. Say what you will about Bill Clinton and his sexual escapades and all that sort of stuff, but here's a man that has been hanging around with known criminals. And I'm not talking about your garden variety criminal. I'm talking about serious stuff. And scoundrels like Bernie Kerik. It is fascinating to me. I mean, this guy was nothing more than a run-of-the-mill political hack, Rudy Giuliani, who made himself into the national hero on September 11th, and he literally did it by himself with his mouth. His actions certainly didn't make him a national hero, and as I would remind you once again that on September the 10th, 2001, the guy's name was Mudd in New York City, and he's never done a damn thing to change that legitimately change that, in my opinion. But he was. He was nothing but a run-of-the-mill hack. And, you know, he made it sound like, you know, he had Bush out there hiding in that bunker in Nebraska. Or was it Lincoln or Omaha, I think it was. Out at the SAC base. And Bush was hiding there. Big, tough guy that he was. And you had Giuliani out playing, you know, Cheney really in charge of things down in the basement of the White House. I tell you, it's a three-ring circus. And here we want to follow up, like I said yesterday, with a guy who's Bush with a brain. And I think that's absolutely true. I don't know what people are thinking. I really don't. I look at that crew running for the presidency over on the Republican side, and I have to say, what are they thinking? What are they thinking? You know, Fred Thompson, one of the most pitiful excuses of a presidential candidate as you could ever want. An empty suit, if there ever was one, running for the presidency. Mitt Romney, dashing good looks. Laura Ingraham, you want to bring back your flip-flopping thing because the flip-flopping designation never fit anybody better than it fits Mitt Romney. What was his real name? I forgot. Leonard or something? It's not Mitt. Okay, anyway, I've forgotten. Well, thanks for being with us today, and I know... we more or less had a historical lesson today on the show about Franklin Roosevelt's Four Freedoms speech, but do me a favor and do yourself a favor and look that up. Look up the whole speech and read it. There's audio of it on the internet. You should hear it. It'll warm your heart. It'll give you renewed confidence in America. And what we stand for, and it'll give you renewed confidence in what the Democratic Party stands for and what it stood for at the time of this great leader, Franklin Roosevelt. Every now and then, it does some good to go back, and I know we're all dissatisfied, or most of us anyway, are dissatisfied right now with a lot of the Democratic leadership. But every now and then, it pays to take a look back in history and look at some of our great leaders and understand what the party could be and should be, once again. Franklin Roosevelt exemplifies the great things about the Democratic Party. He has, ever since his election to office in 1932, and he always will, in the history of America, remain one of the greatest presidents, in my opinion, the greatest president we've ever had, hands down. Thanks for listening today here in the Guy James Show. Please do remember that this is a listener-supported program. Please do remember that. And it's at that time of year when that's critical. You're listening to the Guy James Show and the Head On Radio Network. Thanks to Billy Shears for music direction. And don't forget, you've heard...